This week on Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Residency Podcast.
Lee, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, friends. I'm excited to be here.
So in the case of sarcoid, can you tell us a little bit more about how these hormones lead to hypercalcemia?
They found out that he had had gold implanted in his nose in New York City in the 1940s. We actually talked through a mnemonic that you can use to approach generalized inflammation, and that's RIME, R-I-M-E.
This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance our educational experience. The content, while edited by residents, is not verified by host or speakers, and we are not content experts on these topics. The content provided by this podcast is not intended and should not construe as medical advice. It should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We attempt to avoid use of opinion, but all opinions are our own and not representative of University Medical Center. Please keep this in mind as you enjoy our podcast.
Welcome back to Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
Casey, I'm really excited. We have new chiefs, new year, new everything. It's going to be really exciting and fun.
Yeah, July's been a busy month so far, but we're excited to introduce two brand new chiefs here with us today.
So we're going to kick it off with Lee Richardson, who's the chief across the street.
Lee, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, friends. I'm excited to be here. I'm a little nervous, I'll be honest, but I think hopefully I'm going to do okay. I still feel like this is Peter's chair, I'll be honest, and I'm just kind of inhabiting it for a little bit. We'll see, though. Thank you. I appreciate it.
So just to get everybody to know a little bit more about you, our residents know about you, but fortunately we have a lot of listeners that aren't associated with Vanderbilt. So just tell us where you're from and a little bit about you, Lee.
I love it. Sounds great. So I'm originally from Nicholasville, Kentucky. So it's a small town in central Kentucky. Grew up there. I've got two younger brothers. I love Space Jam, mixtape CDs, Ultimate Frisbee. That pretty much describes my childhood. And then I ended up going to college at the mighty Transylvania University. So only 1,100 students, and it's in Lexington, Kentucky. It's dwarfed by the University of Kentucky. But then I ended up traveling 70-ish miles westward to Louisville for medical school. That's where I met my wife, Mackenzie. So we met on the very first day, went to medical school there, and it was a ton of fun, and then moved down here to Nashville in 2016. So I did 4 years of MedPeds residency and super stoked to be staying on this year.
Yeah, you just wanted to stay another extra year.
Yes, I'm a glutton for punishment, so just keep kicking the can down the road. So definitely worth it, though.
So, and tell us what you're going to be doing when you finish your chief year.
Yeah, so I'm interested in cardiology long term. And so right now it's been kind of a fun transition because I'm actually studying for my pediatric board exam. And so doing all sorts of kids knowledge. And long term, I'm going to be doing adult cardiology, but thinking about doing adult congenital heart disease, heart failure transplant, or even just general adult cardiology.
Perfect. Well, let's go ahead and jump right in with the first case.
All right. So I'm excited to share with you guys three cases that we've had here across the street. These are all actually from our intake conferences. And so we've been getting together doing small in-person conferences. And the first one is from Dr. Corey Jackson. And this was incredible. So I actually wanted to read a medical limerick that is based on this first case.
Very nice.
Okay. So for those of you that don't know, a limerick is a 5-line poem. And these were all actually written by Dr. Stone. So he was the chief resident here in 1964, was an attending for over 50 years, and unfortunately passed away earlier this spring. But this limerick is titled Mental Status Changes. Low energy, irritable regression. Could not answer the simplest question. Multiple nodes had been seen, calciums over 15. This sure wasn't worsening depression. This was hypercalcemia. And so that was Corey's case that he had for us, is he had a 73-year-old man that came in with kind of vague symptoms of dizziness, intermittent confusion, fatigue, as well as some knee pain. His past medical history was most notable just for sarcoidosis, which was biopsy proven. And when he came in, he had a calcium of 15.0.
Lee, in this situation, how do we go about working up this hypercalcemia?
So I think you have to think about two main hormones when we're talking about calcium homeostasis. And so the first one is PTH, which is parathyroid hormone. The first branch point in terms of working up hypercalcemia is everyone should get a PTH, because this is the first branch point in finding out, is this a PTH dependent or a PTH independent process? And if this is PTH dependent, you oftentimes will see an inappropriately normal or elevated PTH despite the hypercalcemia. And so diagnoses to consider there include primary hyperparathyroidism or tertiary hyperparathyroidism, as well as FHH, which is familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia. And so for PTH, I think of three different ways that it increases serum calcium. Two of them are direct, and one of them is indirect. So first off, it acts at the bone to increase bony turnover and releases calcium phosphate from the large reserves that we have in the bones. It also acts at the kidney, and this is by increasing calcium resorption at the proximal tubule. I still remember in medical school when I was taught that PTH is phosphate trashing hormone, so I still think in my head that you're peeing out tons of phosphate while you're reabsorbing lots of calcium, which is going to increase your serum levels. It also acts indirectly at the GI tract, and that's through our buddy vitamin D. It has two forms, vitamin D3, which is cholecalciferol, and vitamin D2, which is ergocalciferol, which comes from our gut and our diet. Both forms, when they're absorbed into the serum, go into the liver, and they become hydroxylated at the 25 position. And this creates the pre-hormone vitamin D that we usually measure whenever we're getting serum levels on our patients. However, to become the active form, it has to become hydroxylated at the 1 position to become dihydroxyvitamin D. And that's where it can travel back to the gut and help with calcium reabsorption.
So Lee, when we think about hypercalcemia, we want to really consider PTH and vitamin D and which one of these might be leading to the hypercalcemia. So in the case of sarcoid, can you tell us a little bit more about how these hormones lead to hypercalcemia?
It's interesting because I think when most people think about hypercalcemia, mechanisms that go through their head are those osteoclasts that are chewing up tons of bone, spitting out lots of calcium phosphate. But that's actually not a significant contributor in sarcoid. It's actually related to the granulomas. And so granulomas are very metabolically active centers, and they have macrophages and giant cells and high concentrations of that enzyme I was talking about earlier at the kidney, 1-alpha hydroxylase. And so what this does is this is essentially an ectopic site that converts 25-OH vitamin D, the measured form, all the way to the active form of 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D. And there's no physiologic feedback, no homeostatic control. And so this can lead to high gut reabsorption of calcium, which is what's driving the hypercalcemia in these patients.
I've really only seen hypercalcemia treated in malignancy, which I don't know if we're going to touch on that today or not, Lee. But how does the treatment differ if the mechanism is different?
That's awesome, Casey. Yeah, and you're exactly right, because there are a number of different treatment modalities that we have, and it really depends on the etiology of what's going to work best for each patient. And so I think a classic medicine class that we see are the bisphosphonates, and they typically inhibit digestion of bone by promoting osteoclast apoptosis. And so we've seen maybe in the ICU zoledronic acid that's used in really severe cases. This drug actually takes a little bit to kick in, and so oftentimes it's bridged with calcitonin, so another hormone that we talk about with calcium homeostasis, because calcitonin can kick in pretty quickly. But the treatment of choice in sarcoid patients and other granulomatous diseases actually isn't either of those, because there's not a whole lot of turnover at the bones. Remember that a lot of the reason why we're seeing the hypercalcemia is related to changes in vitamin D metabolism. And so the treatment of choice is steroids. This actually inhibits 1-alpha hydroxylase and stops this inappropriate vitamin D activation in the granulomas.
Interesting. So it's not that the steroids are doing anything to the granuloma. It's actually inhibiting that enzyme?
Yes. And so, it'll cause changes in the 1-alpha hydroxylase and stop inappropriate vitamin D activation. And so you can see this on the lab findings as well, which was cool in Corey's patient, because when they measured the normal vitamin D levels, they're actually at the low level of normal at 30. But when they measured the 1,25 or the active vitamin D levels, it was 165.
Wow.
And so the normal range for that would be anywhere from the teens up to the 60s and 70s. So it was significantly elevated. And one of the other great teaching points that we got here was related to some cardiac teaching from Dr. Campbell. He taught us about some of the expected findings with EKGs that you would see with calcium changes. So with hypercalcemia, one would expect to see a shortened QTC. And in fact, when we went back and looked at the EKG of this patient, they had a QTC of 371. And so it's important to think about with electrolyte changes that you can think of calcium making horizontal changes, meaning that with hypercalcemia, you'll shorten the QT interval. Hypocalcemia, you'll lengthen the QT interval. Whereas potassium, I like to think of that more vertically, where hyperkalemia will cause some of those peak T waves that we see in some of the early hyperkalemic changes, whereas hypokalemia will cause T wave flattening and shortening.
That was a great first case, Lee. Can you give us some take-home points for it?
So I think that when you're working up hypercalcemia, every patient should have a PTH level that's ordered, because that's the first branch point in finding out the etiology, is if the hypercalcemia is PTH dependent or PTH independent. in regards to specifically granulomatous disease, for management, we oftentimes will treat with steroid therapy because that targets at the level of the granuloma due to that faulty vitamin D metabolism, as opposed to maybe some other cases such as hypercalcemia malignancy, where we would expect to treat with bisphosphonates, calcitonin, and then with all these patients, aggressive fluid resuscitation. All right, friends, I'm excited to share with you another case here, but I do have a question for you because you asked questions to me. What do you think of when you go digging for gold?
How much I can earn to put towards my student loans?
I like that answer.
Digging for gold. For some reason, the only thing I can think of is the movie Holes.
Great movie. Last time I saw Shia LaBeouf and was happy. But I would have to say that I thought of picking my nose when I thought of digging for gold. And what if I told you that Claudio Tombazzi and Chase Webber, with the help of ENT, went into a patient's nose and struck a gold mine?
Please elaborate.
I'm really excited too. So they took care of a gentleman who presented with significant epistaxis and nasal bleeding. And so they tried a lot of measures, including pressure, TXA, and oxymetazoline in order to help resolve the bleeding, but they weren't able to stop it. And so they had to call the ENT colleagues, who first recommended getting a CT of this patient's maxillary sinuses. And after getting the CT scan, they found a significant mass, which was in the posterior nasopharynx. ENT at the bedside ended up doing a biopsy, which demonstrated a right-sided necrotic mass. And so they eventually got a tissue diagnosis of nasopharyngeal angiofibroma. That's an interesting disease because it's something that we usually see in children. However, something else on the CT scan is what really caught everyone's attention, in addition to that finding, is that there were multiple small metallic objects located at the right pterygoid bone.
Multiple metallic what now?
So when they went back and took more history from the patient, they found out that he had had gold implanted in his nose in New York City in the 1940s. They had to do some digging after trying to figure out what this meant. And what they found out is that the patient reportedly had had multiple nasal polyps. And as a treatment for different nasal conditions, there was a group of doctors in New York City throughout the 40s and the 60s that placed gold seeds into the nose. And so these tiny seeds are, you can fit about 10 to 15 of them on a penny, and they typically are filled with radioactive materials. So this is like an old school form of brachytherapy, to where the radionuclides would slowly release radioactive material, possibly into tumors or other things that they were implanted in.
Wow.
I don't even know what to say.
Very classic.
So they implanted radioactive gold seeds into children's noses.
It was unclear if these gold seeds had radioactive material in them or not. Okay. However, in the literature search that I saw, they typically were used as a form of brachytherapy and treatment of locally invasive cancers.
But now you're telling us he has a cancer in the same region, so I feel like there's more to the story.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And so they're still waiting on some final staining and pathology, but there's some concern that maybe these seeds had precipitated and caused some of this tumor to form.
Well, that's going to be the weirdest thing we talk about today.
Absolutely. And kudos to Chase Webber as well as Claudio for sharing that case with me, because it was very interesting to see. And I think we all had some cool learning. All right. And my final case is from Eric Lander and Joe Quintana. And so Eric actually presented the case, but I wanted to give Joe credit because he's the one that worked up the case and did an excellent job and taught us about great approaches to working up a patient with inflammation. And so Eric gave a case of a gentleman. He's a 70-year-old man who's had Still's disease, who presented with subacute progressive dyspnea, daily fevers, as well as worsening pancytopenia. There are lots of different teaching points here because this patient had Still's disease, and then also there was concern for a diagnosis of HLH. Both of these are diseases that we don't see very frequently, so I wanted to touch on some things here early on in the year that I think can be applicable to every resident. And so the first is the creation of a problem representation. I know everyone is rolling their eyes that's listened to my intern boot camp, because I've been talking about creating problem representations a lot with our interns. But in my opinion, this is a super important way to develop your clinical gestalt and also to articulate your thoughts to consultants and to other providers. I wanted to read Joe's exact problem representation, a 70-year-old man with Still's disease that's presenting with subacute progressive dyspnea, daily fevers, and worsening pancytopenia. And so I love how this single sentence encapsulated most of the pertinent findings of this patient's presentation. And so remember that a problem representation should include demographics and risk factors. So that includes the patient's age, their gender, and then any important past medical history that they may have. You also should comment on the timing, and that includes both the length, so whether this is a hyperacute and acute process, or if this is something that's chronic and been going on for much longer, as well as the tempo. Is this something that's progressive? Is it waxing and waning? Is it intermittent? And then finally, you should hone in on the key signs and symptoms, and be sure to include specific localizing features, but ignore some of the more general ones, such as malaise and fatigue, because those don't help us hone in on a specific diagnosis.
I agree with you, Lee. I think it's really important, especially early in the year, that we think about these fundamentals. I mean, problem representation, making problem lists, things like that, and really organizing your thought processes into a way that you can attack things. So how did our group attack these problems? How did they go about working this up?
Yeah, so I think Joe did an excellent job when it got to the point where I asked him for his differential diagnosis. And so we actually talked through a mnemonic that you can use to approach generalized inflammation, and that's RIME, R-I-M-E. And so starting out with rheumatologic diseases, he considered that maybe this Still's disease is what was causing his significant pancytopenia, as well as this daily fevers that he was having. And then maybe he had not had an appropriate diagnosis early on, and this could have represented something like lupus. For the I, he mentioned a number of infections. And so this included opportunistic infections, as well as some fungal and some non-typical bacterial etiologies. For the M in malignancy, he mentioned a number of blood malignancies, such as MDS, AML, and then he also mentioned HLH, or hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis, secondary to the patient's Still's disease. Finally, with the E, you can consider endocrine causes of inflammation, although this seemed a little less likely in this patient's case.
Lee, that was a really big word. From now on, we can call it HLH. So why don't you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to just saying HLH. This is actually a syndrome of excessive inflammation and tissue destruction. And as a med-peds physician, I've actually only seen two cases of it, and both of them were in children. And so more commonly, it does occur in younger patients. And in children, a lot of the cases are familial. Now, when you're thinking about HLH, I was classically taught that you could describe whether it was primary HLH related to a genetic cause or genetic factor, or secondary HLH, such as something like an infection or a malignancy that was triggering HLH to occur. However, there have been recent statements that say we shouldn't be using these terms. And this is actually from one of my favorite organizations, NACHO, the North American Consortium for Histiocytosis. I had not actually heard of them until preparing for this, but I do think that is an incredible acronym. But they say that we should not be using those terms because even patients that have underlying genetic abnormalities may have an environmental trigger that begins a patient down this pathway of HLH. And physiologically, what happens is patients develop impaired cytotoxic function of lymphocytes, specifically the NK cells, which make up about 10 to 15% of our lymphocytes. And this is coupled with excessive activation of our macrophages. If you look at it under a microscope, what you'll see in the bone marrow biopsy are characteristic pathological findings of hemophagocytosis, or this is the presence of red blood cells or white blood cells actually inside of the cytosol of macrophages. These changes, in addition to massive cytokine storm, leads to multi-system organ failure and significant morbidity and mortality in this patient population.
And Lee, that's a good point about the primary versus secondary. And the way that I think about it, I've actually seen this a couple of times as well. The first time that I saw it, I remember thinking, oh my gosh, we have the diagnosis, it's HLH. And they said, well, sort of, but not really, because there's still something that's causing the HLH most likely. And figuring out what that is just as important.
That's exactly right. And so looking for some of those triggers include infections. A lot of times it's more viral etiologies, such as Epstein-Barr virus, cytomegalovirus, HIV, parvovirus, and then recently there are actually two reported cases with SARS-CoV-2 as well. In addition, you need to consider malignancies such as lymphoid cancers and leukemias, as well as rheumatologic diseases. And so one thing I'll point out, because my wife is a future pediatric rheumatologist, is that when it occurs in children or young adults with systemic juvenile idiopathic arthritis, or JIA, it should be called MAS, or macrophage activation syndrome, as opposed to HLH in those patients.
You mentioned that the diagnosis can be made from bone marrow biopsy, seeing white and red blood cells inside the macrophages. Do we have to do a bone marrow biopsy on everyone in whom we suspect this?
That's a great point, Casey. And actually, the diagnosis is pretty nuanced because you have to meet a certain number of diagnostic criteria in order to truly diagnose HLH. And I will put in the caveat is oftentimes when you're getting near the end of the road and you have high suspicion, you definitely want to involve our hematology colleagues in order to help out. But I'll give some general points that should maybe tip you to consider this. One would be fever. And so patients definitely have to have fever. And then some objective findings of splenomegaly, cytopenias involving at least two cell lines, as well as hypertriglyceridemia. Once you have those things, you could also consider sending a serum ferritin because these patients have significantly elevated ferritin levels, at least greater than 500. And if you're checking all those boxes, I would say it's time to involve the hematology colleagues and send some of the more specialized tests. One of my last teaching points that I wanted to bring up that I thought was interesting is if you just happen to see an isolated elevated ferritin, what sorts of diagnoses should you be considering? So as I did a literature search for this, I ended up finding an article that was at an academic medical center, and the authors were here at Vanderbilt. And so one of the last authors is someone from here across the street, Dr. Howard Fuchs. And so in this study, what they ended up looking at were patients who had an elevated ferritin of greater than 1,000. And the most significant causes of this included iron overload syndromes, which was the second most common cause. However, the most frequent condition was malignancy. So definitely keep those two diagnoses in mind should you see a very elevated ferritin level in your patient.
And that's something that I've actually seen residents will just see an elevated ferritin. Like they'll see a ferritin of 2,000 and immediately jump to HLH. And so it's good to bring up those other points, fever, cytopenia, splenomegaly, hypertriglyceridemia, and thinking about HLH before just calling hematology and saying, hey, there's a really high ferritin.
Absolutely. Well, thank you guys. That's all I have for today.
Lee, thank you so much for talking with us today. I still can't get the nose gold out of my head. I think I'm going to remember that hopefully forever.
Lee, thanks so much for joining us today. We really had a lot of fun and we're looking forward to having you on all year and learning a lot from you.
Well, I'm excited to be here. So thanks for coming over here across the street.
And that'll do it for this episode. Stay tuned for our next episode with Blake at Vanderbilt.